Welcome to Globally Speaking, a podcast dedicated to unlocking global understanding. Join us as we engage with experts and innovators who are reshaping the way we connect with global audiences. Whether seeking to refine your approach, wanting to expand your understanding of AI and its role in transcending global communication barriers, or just curious about the intricacies of global content, this podcast promises to enlighten and inspire.
How do you unlock global understanding in crisis situations around the world? Well, digital services and digital access to information are essential to help crisis-affected and disadvantaged groups. But as you can imagine, there are many barriers preventing everyone from accessing information online or on apps in the same way. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Globally Speaking podcast. I'm Marine Esquenet, social media manager at AWS, and today I'm honored to be joined by two colleagues from Clear Global, Amy Ansari, CEO, and Ellie Kemp, head of research, evidence, and advocacy. Clear Global, formerly Translators Without Borders, is a non-profit organization that helps people get vital information and have their voices heard, whatever language they speak and wherever they are in the world. Today, we're here to talk about digital inclusion and exclusion of minority language speakers in crisis situations. A warm welcome to you both, Amy and Ellie, and thank you so much for being here. Humanitarian actors sometimes overlook the needs and priorities of marginalized groups if they fail to listen and communicate in the right language, which is the language they use. You have conducted a study on the topic that will be published very soon. Can you maybe define what language exclusion actually means and tell us more on the origins of this research?
Sure. So language exclusion is when you can't make yourself heard, as you were describing earlier, or get information or access services because of the language that you speak or the language of the service providers, the language that the information is available in. Often it combines with literacy and other barriers, as you were discussing. In humanitarian emergencies, obviously not being able to access information, not being able to hold service providers to account or let them know what it is you need, is a major issue. The stakes are very, very high when there's an emergency. Yeah. And this piece of research actually came out of conversations we've been having over years with colleagues at the GSMA Foundation. So GSMA is a grouping of mobile operators and other businesses associated with that sector. The foundation works on innovation and inclusion within that space, and we've been working with the part of the GSMA Foundation that focuses on mobile, the use of mobile technology in emergencies, the mobile for humanitarian. And over the last, particularly the last 7 years, we've been publishing research findings and data as Clear Global about the impact of language exclusion and how it happens in humanitarian emergencies. Typically, the starting point is that humanitarian organizations, international humanitarian organizations particularly, they think in English, they speak in English, they develop their strategies and their programs in English. So to have access to be part of that design process, you have to be able to speak English. Mm-hmm. They then go to, say, to a country like Congo, and they will translate a bunch of that into French. Mm-hmm. But most of the population of Congo don't speak French. Yeah. And certainly those that do speak French as a, you know, as a lingua franca, as a contact language, don't speak it well enough to be able to engage in a strategic discussion about the needs of, you know, so the people that speak the 200 plus languages of DRC never get to be part of those conversations. And because the whole aid sector can be a little bit of a bubble, to coordinate between organizations, you need to be able to speak English or French or in certain parts of the world, Arabic. Essentially, it remains focused in these dominant languages. And so the people who can't get in remain invisible is the risk. And it is what happens still too much. Things have changed. I think we really have seen things change. And there are examples now of organizations very much taking this on board. But still, it is too easy in the aid sector generally. And we've looked a lot, particularly at emergency responses, to talk amongst yourselves and not simply not know what the needs are, not be able to hear the voices of marginalized language speakers. So speakers of languages that are not given prominence, not given space, not part of the, not represented in political terms, not powerful in economic terms within a particular context. Mm-hmm. So in the big Ebola responses in DRC, for instance, 2018, 2019, huge Ebola outbreak, which centered very much on the north of North Kivu. The biggest language there is Nande, but the materials that were developed to communicate with the people at risk about those risks and about what to do were not in Nande. And so a lot of the information simply didn't get through. Sorry, so we have been having conversations with GSMA and others over the last few years about how that kind of problem plays out in an emergency and about the kind of what we've been finding through our research and what we've been able to do with partners to address it. And we've been talking to them about, well, how does this work with digital services? There's been a big expansion of digital technology in the aid sector, as in many other parts of all of our lives over recent years. How is language inclusion or language exclusion being taken on board in the development of those technologies?
That sounds so interesting. And can I ask you, how does that fit into your general mission, you know, as a Clear Global or Translators Without Borders?
Great question. Thanks. So as Ellie said, the digital space has increased so much over the last few years. One of the things we have suspected all along, but have never been able to demonstrate at all, was that the growth in people's ability to get digital information was growing, but it was that expansion in digital in the digital space was leaving people behind. It was leaving people behind who didn't speak the lingua franca, didn't speak languages of power, English, French, Russian, Chinese, whatever. And it's one of the things we had, you know, we kind of say and have suspected. And we've been talking, as Ellie said, to the GSMA Foundation for very many years about how language is a barrier or not a barrier to people getting information, getting their voices heard, particularly via mobile phones. Mm-hmm. And so Ellie and her team were very successful in talking to GSMA and getting this piece of research done, because it will really further both our understanding of exclusion or inclusion of people who speak marginalized languages, but not just ours. It's a piece of research that will be used by mobile service providers all around the world and looked at and read. It is, GSMA is that association that has that kind of influence in the world. So from my perspective and from Clear Global's perspective, it's an incredible sort of foundational piece of research to demonstrate what the gaps are. And I think it's also important in terms of the localization industry, because it's something that, as an industry, we can build on and advocate for more digital inclusion of more languages.
Based on proper stats that you managed to gather and, findings. Exactly. I would really love to go a bit, you know, to dig a bit deeper into the kind of mobile and access to smartphones, really, but we can do this a bit later. I have questions dedicated to this later. Maybe you can start by giving us some key findings you'd like to share, just, you know, to give a nice context to our listeners.
Sure. So I'd say four things. There's a lot. There's a mass in this, and it's very hard to pull out four things. One is that there are absolutely digital services that marginalized language speakers want to use, but in order to do so, they have to overcome language barriers in particular, also literacy and other barriers. And in an emergency, as we were saying earlier, the stakes are high, that can have major consequences. So we were talking to civil society organizations who are working with marginalized communities and hearing about how people, you know, they can't access certain services, even common services, without getting somebody's help to do so, because they simply can't read in that particular language, or in some cases that they're able to use, it was often social networking and messaging platforms, even though they can't read the interface, somebody shows them how to do it the first time, and then they're in, and they use voice notes whenever they can, often, they use platforms like TikTok where you can use video that don't require you to be able to write in the language of the platform.
Right, got it. And they remember where the buttons are and where is
exactly.
what, and they don't really
exactly.
know.
The simpler
know what
the process,
it says.
The more intuitive of the interface, the better that works.
Of
so that's
course.
One thing. And there is a lot of good work. We also spoke to a lot of organizations in the humanitarian space in particular that are doing some really good work to try to make their digital services, the humanitarian digital services especially, more accessible through language and also through other more accessible means of communication, pictorial communication, speech communication, use of plain language and so on. But despite that, a lot of that work, most of that work still remains focused on certainly the dominant languages of any
right.
context. So if it's in Central and South America, it's almost certainly in Spanish and not necessarily in many other languages. Beyond that, if it's in the Middle East, it's in Arabic. Is it also in Kurdish and the other smaller languages within those contexts? If it's in East Africa, it's in Swahili, but it's in the Swahili of Kenya and Tanzania. It's not in the Swahili, for instance, of DR Congo. And also really interesting for me was that the organizations providing those services can't always see, they haven't always set themselves up to be able to see who they're missing through those language choices. Because the platforms that they work in collect data on users and not on non-users. So there's a blind spot there. What the biggest factor that pretty much everybody referred to in terms of the challenges that they faced expanding, reaching out to more marginalized languages, which typically they were wanting to do, is cost. And there is a real opportunity that a number of them are already taking to use language technology to bring costs down and also to increase that accessibility by using, for instance, speech technology. Mm. And then the last thing I'd say that really came through from the fact that we were talking to three different groups that don't necessarily speak to each other very much about this topic. So we were talking to language technology experts. We were talking to civil society organizations from marginalized communities or working with marginalized communities. And we were speaking to international aid organizations developing digital services. And pulling that together, you could really see that there were complementarities between them that aren't really being used, certainly not being used at the moment, to the benefit of marginalized language speakers. So humanitarian organizations, when they are engaging with smaller languages, shall we say, mm-hmm. with marginalized or minority languages, they're generating an awful lot of content, often voice content, in those languages. And they're getting, mm-hmm. through their interaction with speakers of those languages, they're getting a lot of content, often voice content in those languages. There is an opportunity there to develop technology in particular for those languages.
Yeah.
The language technologists lack that data. That's the piece that they're missing in order to develop it. So there's a huge opportunity. If we can find a way to really materialize that does not exploit communities, that is in their benefits, that has their informed consent, that could really be a game changer for their access to services and also their ability to participate in global conversations. Mm-hmm. It's a very far-reaching thing, potentially.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, as you were talking, I was wondering, because, you know, in those countries, I guess a lot of people are considered bilingual. But there's bilingual and bilingual. So, for example, you can be completely at ease with a language, but still, when you have to deal with something that is a bit more technical or something, you know, that... You might still miss some tools there, even though, you know, everyone else considers you bilingual and they therefore consider you have access to this information. That might be another blind spot.
Absolutely. You're putting your finger on a key point that's come up in pretty much every piece of research we've ever done, and which came through very strongly here in terms of the development of language technology that could serve marginalized language speakers. They with several people that we, several older women that we tested comprehension of that, those terms with, said, I think that means diarrhea. So you have a, you know, you can't have that conversation. You first need to make sure that people are understanding it. And that's a lot about using plain language in that language, about understanding what words people use to discuss certain concepts. But in relation to language technology, one thing that came through from these interviews is that the language technology that is available, even for those big languages, doesn't work for second language speakers of it. So technologists were telling us that, you know, Brazilian Portuguese and European Portuguese, fine. But if you're from Cape Verde or if you're from Angola, then the speech technology simply doesn't recognize what you're saying.
Okay.
And it's the same with French, and it's the same. The same with language technology for many big languages. So working to make the existing language technology more robust for, so that it can understand the way in which a Congolese speaker from Eastern Congo, second language speaker, uses Swahili, or the way in which somebody from Angola speaks when they're using Portuguese, particularly for a particular topic, could really massively expand access. It won't reach everybody. There is a section of every population, particularly the more marginalized, the more likely you are to have sections of the population, particularly old people, people with disabilities, women in many cases, who are going to be monolingual. And this will not help them. But there are many, many millions that could potentially be supported by that. And that means gathering the language data, which is the raw material for language technology, if you like, from people who speak those languages as a second language, so that you can hear how they mix in other languages, which happens an awful lot when it's a lingua franca, a contact language, their different accents, their different dialects, the different ways in which they speak. There's a huge opportunity there that could be taken. And I think that's something that really needs to be investigated based on data, based on first understanding who uses those languages and how. And hearing from them.
Ellie, I understand that you actually did the research, you digged into this. I think you already mentioned a couple of things, but maybe do you have any anecdotes that you have from key informant interviews that you had for the research that you want to share with us?
Yeah, there are millions, but let me give you one or two. One civil society organization that we were speaking to in Pakistan was highlighting how in the huge floods of 2022, there was risk communication that was going out to communities by SMS in Urdu, which is the state language, but it's spoken by 11% of the population, and not largely by most of the people most affected or most at risk from this. So they didn't get the information. Right. She said that the person we were talking to, the colleague we were speaking to, said, well, I got the information, but I'm in Islamabad. So that was not very useful to me.
Yeah.
And it was simply not getting through. Speaking to a gentleman from Somalia who is a member of a minority group and working with other minority and marginalized communities, was saying the humanitarian sector simply hasn't been interested in us. Until very recently, they haven't made an effort to speak to us in our languages. And so none of the information reaches a speaker of a marginalized group within Somalia, unless they're already quite well educated and already speak the Somali national language and the right dialect of the Somali national language. And that caused them to distrust and to feel disregarded by an aid sector, which isn't meaning to do that. And simply wasn't. If we don't set ourselves up to be able to listen, then we are telling people they're unimportant, and that's
I mean, it's exactly what, you know, the feeling. I think I would feel the same way. You know what I mean? But in reality, does that mean that the government is taking the decision or making the decision? Sorry, of communicating in this only one language, knowing for sure that only 15%. You know, like, how do we explain this?
That's a big question. Governments generally that have very linguistically diverse populations often don't want that data because it's quite hard to manage, and they don't they want to build a national identity.
Right.
So that's one issue, and that means that when aid organizations come in to respond in a new emergency, the data is not necessarily readily available. So one of the things we've been doing as Clear Global is to hunt out the data that's available, curate it, and put it into maps to make it more accessible for humanitarians and others who are trying to support those communities. So they know where to start. What are at least the first three languages we should start communicating in?
Well, Amy, now for you, I guess this is those facts are not new to you, and you have to face them every day. Like, did you find anything particularly interesting in the results that you would like to share?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Ellie does, we've done a lot of research in the organization, and I always find something fascinating or new in it. This time there were a couple of things that I found fascinating. One thing was an organization in Northeast Nigeria is using a read out loud, you know, so women can get whatever's on the screen read out loud. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's only in English. Mm-hmm. What I found interesting, though, was that they were using it. And there isn't the technology yet to be able to use it in any other language. So I thought that was really a great thing that organization was doing. And also how we, as people who work in language technology, are failing them. And I think the other thing that was really interesting to me, and you guys were just talking about it, was like the fintech, right? Mobile money is, like, those apps are only in some of the big major languages. That's one of the things that that Elliot's research found. But, you know, people were figuring out how to use it, no matter, even if they couldn't understand what button and how to push and all of that. You kind of know that that's happening around you. Like, you know, I do it with my parents too. Like, they can't use something, so I help them figure out how to use it, which is fine. But what startled me and kind of made me a bit worried was that they were asking, you know, the guy standing next to them in the shop, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really, that's making vulnerable people even more vulnerable. And so for me, maybe it wasn't exactly surprising, but it was a bit scary in that by making, you know, mobile money more accessible, but not by making it understandable, we are potentially making already vulnerable people even more vulnerable.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is a super good introduction to my next question, actually, the one I mentioned before with, you know, access to smartphones. There's a lot of content in your research about how language is a form of exclusion itself, and then combined with other criteria like age, disability, gender, this can make some people particularly vulnerable. Can you give us a couple of examples for this other than the one you just mentioned? And also, I'm thinking, I guess, of gender disparities in particular when it comes to access to technology. For example, we know that women around the world have fewer smartphones. In this direction, do you have other examples, basically?
Absolutely. One of the civil society organizations we spoke to was working with communities, speakers of marginalized languages in isolated parts of India, what are termed tribal communities in India. And there, you could see these multiple layers of barriers that people have to get through in order to use, in order to access information that's online or to access services online. So if people from these communities get online, the information and the opportunities to raise complaints or concerns simply aren't available in their languages at the moment. But women are especially excluded from any attempt to engage through technology. Because they don't have access to phones. It's their husbands who have the phones. Because in these, the communities that this colleague was working with, they haven't had the education to have the literacy skills or the numeracy skills to make easy use of a phone. And because they don't they simply don't have access to it. So we would, the key informant I was speaking to from the civil society organization was telling me that in the research they did, they found that women over the age of 30, I don't consider this to be older women, women over the age of 30 had only used phones when somebody else had dialed a number and handed them the phone. They didn't even have the experience of dialing a number on a phone. Yeah. That was a bit of an eye-opener to me. I think it hadn't occurred to me.
So
one of the things that this organization did was provide the kind of coaching and support to help those women become more familiar, more confident using even a basic phone for communication and access to information. And the other one, which I think is really relevant for the aid sector, was in Northeast Nigeria. So aid organizations are increasingly using digital technology and SMS technology to register people to receive assistance. And one of the people we were speaking to in Nigeria was a member of the Mafa community, which is a very marginalized section of the population. Many of the Mafa speakers don't have a good level of education, if any education at all. They're unfamiliar with technology because they haven't had access to it. And they're not in direct contact with aid organizations verbally because the aid organizations in Northeast Nigeria mostly speak Hausa, and not all of the Mafa do. And so we heard that this really facilitated aid diversion when, you know, unscrupulous individuals, recognizing that Mafa community members weren't able to read themselves the message that they got, which invited them to register for assistance, couldn't read or make use of the message telling them this is your registration number that you must use to access that assistance, took advantage and took the aid for themselves. So that's a major risk if we're taking advantage of the technology makes possible in terms of reaching people who otherwise would find it difficult to be in face-to-face contact. We have to be aware of what the risks are.
And I guess, I mean, in the same direction, but as an LSP, where, you know, like I'm very, or we are, and I am, I'm a translator, actually I studied translation, I'm very close to language and this relationship with language and how it's all evolving, right, in terms of technology, AI. How do you think this can be helpful or maybe hurtful to this language-based exclusion? Do you think this can have an impact in terms of how quick it's evolving and where it's going at the moment?
Certainly, pretty much everybody I spoke to was very aware of the danger of increasing the digital divide. It already exists. We know it exists. But it can amplify existing inequalities and leave people further behind and give them less space to participate, less opportunity to influence the decisions that affect them. So, you know, that's the downside. But I think, as I was saying, there is a huge potential if we can find safe ways with marginalized communities to access the potential, develop the potential of language technology. It can have a huge impact. It can help people access services that they wouldn't have access to otherwise. They can do it for themselves. They're not reliant on somebody else. That's a, you know, that's a protection concern. It can enable them to participate in decisions that affect them. It can enable them to hold people, organizations, governments, institutions to account. And ultimately, they can be in control of their own communication and information access. Amy and I have long had a dream of, I think we've been talking about it since we first started working in Northeast Nigeria in about 2017. Because of this multi-layered barriers to access, the older disabled Waha speaking displaced woman in this IDP camp is about the last person who's going to find what services are available to her, how she registers for them, or to make a complaint if they go wrong or if she's abused in any way. We want that older disabled Waha-speaking woman in Northeast Nigeria to have her own device with, you know, Google Translate in Waha that works well enough that actually produces a decent output so that she can use it to communicate and to read the information on the back of the medicine packet. Yeah. We want her to have, you know, another tool like Microsoft Translator or any of those apps, but working in Waha on the basis of open source language technology for her language so that she doesn't have to wait for somebody to come along and interpret for her. She can go up and say, hey, you aid worker walking through my camp, I need to tell you something. So she has control of her own communication, her own information needs. That's ultimately what language and language technology can provide. That's the dream.
And it's quite powerful, isn't it? Is that where you're trying to go with this research? As in, what would the ideal case outcome, you know, what do you and GSMA expect to achieve with it, really, on the long term, in an ideal world?
This was a landscaping piece. We did this because when we looked at it with GSMA, we saw that there simply wasn't the data to start saying what is the situation. So this was meant to be a first kind of grounding of this is how things are in terms of language in digital inclusion in the humanitarian sector. What I think GSMA are hoping for, certainly what we're hoping for, is to use it to start a conversation.
Right.
A little bit of a reality check. And particularly seeing that those three groups of marginalized communities, international humanitarian organizations, and language technology experts are not currently in communication about how they might work together for the benefit of people who are currently excluded. Starting that conversation, those conversations, would be a really positive outcome. There's a lot of work that would entail. There's a lot more that we need to understand, and hopefully will also be a starting point for more focused research on the pieces of this that can really make a difference.
Yeah. Can I ask you to finish this podcast? I mean, I still have two questions actually, but how does AWS and particularly our AWS Foundation? So for those of you who don't know, AWS, we have a charity that provides ways for donors and volunteers to break down language barriers over three different areas, language and content transformation, diversity, equity and inclusion, and quality education. So how do we help you with your mission, really, of unlocking global understanding? How is our help useful to you?
RWS is one of our major donors in the organization and one of our favorite. I love the foundation and have been working closely with RWS for very, very many years. The funding, you're a Sapphire sponsor of the organization, and that funding helps us to build that foundation in the organization so that we can have the conversations with GSMA and do the research. It helps us to be able to start responding to a crisis as soon as it happens, instead of having to sort of run around trying to find the resources to do it. Because we have the funding from RWS every year, it means that we don't have to worry about spending a whole lot of time trying to find that money to do things, or trying to find people who can talk about it. We have it, we know it's there, we can use it to really leverage. We have the money from the Sapphire sponsorship from RWS that we leverage in order to have much bigger impact. So for every dollar that RWS donates to the organization, we turn that into probably $10,000, $20,000 in programming. So super, super important, very, very valuable to us, and very much appreciated. And also, because that's not the only thing the RWS Foundation does. You also help us with project management, particularly in crisis response. You always put out calls for PMs to help us when there is a crisis that hits and we suddenly get overwhelmed with requests. RWS is always very happy to help us with that. You also help us to translate information, particularly on some of our bigger, more complex projects. We ask for support from the RWS Foundation for our partners like Catholic Relief Services or Operation Smile International. Just in the last couple of months, that's been about 14,000 words. So maybe not a whole lot, but it means a heck of a lot to those organizations and to us. You're currently working with our production team on a demo on how to submit project requests for your project managers to be able to manage, including requesting desktop publishing, which is super valuable for us and very interesting. It will save us time and energy and money. So thank you very much to the foundation.
Well, thank you for this nice explanation and your kind words. And I think we can all agree that you're doing an amazing job. So we're more than happy to help and keep doing what you're doing. It's amazing. Maybe one last thing is, what's next for you at Clear Global, Translators Without Borders? Do you have anything you wanna share in terms of what you hope the future will hold?
So something that I think every organization can relate to, any organization that's been through a period of growth, as we have in the last few years, one of the big priorities for next year is changing our finance system. So that will, of course, take quite a lot of management time. And, you know, it will be stressful and all of that for the next year. But apart from that, one of the things we're trying to do is, as Ellie is leading a team, to really bring together the impact that we have and our ability to talk about it and storytelling within the organization, particularly outside of the organization. So that's a big priority for us. And of course, we'll keep the ongoing work in Nigeria and Democratic Republic of Congo and Bangladesh and the global work that we do, like the piece of research that Ellie's been talking about. So that will all stay. We will continue to respond to crises that are multilingual when that is appropriate and necessary. We, of course, want to be working very, very closely within the localization industry to make sure that the skills and technology and knowledge of the industry are leveraged best for people who speak marginalized languages so that they can get information and be heard, whatever language they speak. Thank you very much for having me.
What a nice end to this podcast. Thank you so much for, you know, taking the time to be here today and explain all those like amazing things that you're doing. And I really wish you all the possible success in this project. And yeah, hopefully talk to you soon. I hope everyone enjoyed this podcast as much as I did. And stay tuned for the next one then. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Ellie.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.